Welcome to Audiobook Break with Audiophile Magazine, where twice a week you can hear unabridged classic audiobooks one chapter at a time. We're listening to Homer's The Iliad, read by Anton Lesser and published by Naxos Audiobooks.
Book 23. The Funeral Games for Patroclus. Meanwhile, as Trojans were lamenting in the city, Achaeans reached their ships beside the Hellespont. There they scattered, each man going to his own ship. But Achilles didn't let his Myrmidons disband. He spoke out to his warrior companions. "Fast-riding Myrmidons, trusty comrades, let's not loose our sure-footed horses yet, untying them from their chariots. We must go with horse and chariot up to Patroclus to mourn for him, for that's a dead man's right. Once we've had our fill of sorrowful tears, we'll unyoke our horses. Then all eat here." At these words they all began their group lament, led by Achilles. Three times around the body they drove their well-groomed horses, mourning as they went. Thetis stirred up in them a strong desire to weep. Their tears made the sands wet, men's armour too, for they were mourning the loss of a great warrior who'd made men flee. Peleus' son led their loud lament, placing his man-killing hands on his comrade's chest. "Rest in peace, Patroclus. Even though you're in Hades' house, for I'm completing here all I promised you before, to drag in Hector, then give him to the dogs to eat up raw, and cut the throats of 12 young Trojans' splendid children on your funeral pyre, in my rage that you've been slaughtered." He finished. Then he continued to dishonour noble Hector, stretching his body out face down in the dirt beside the bier of Menoetius' son. Then each man took off his glittering bronze armour. They untied their loud neighing horses, then sat down, thousands of them by swift-footed Achilles' ship. He prepared a funeral feast to ease their spirits. Many sleek oxen bellowed underneath the knife as they were butchered. Many sheep, bleating goats and white-tusked pigs rich in fat were laid out to roast over Hephaestus' fires. All around the corpse blood ran so thick, men scooped it up in cupfuls. Then Achaean leaders led the swift-footed prince, son of Peleus, to Lord Agamemnon. They had trouble convincing him to go there. His heart was still so angry for his comrade. Reaching Agamemnon's hut, they issued orders for clear-voiced heralds to heat a large cauldron up to see if they could persuade Peleus' son to wash, to rinse off the spattered blood. In his stubbornness, he refused to do that, swearing this oath: "By Zeus, highest and most excellent of all the gods, it's not right that water touch my head until I've laid Patroclus on his fire, piled up a burial mound and shaved my hair, since such grief will never reach my heart a second time, not while I still remain among the living. But for the moment let's agree to dine, though I hate to eat. In the morning, Agamemnon, king of men, you must urge men to gather wood, arrange all things required for a man who's died, as he goes below to murky darkness, so tireless fires can cremate him quickly and remove him from our sight. Then soldiers can resume their duties." Achilles spoke. They all listened to him and readily agreed. Men all rushed out, prepared a meal, and dined, eating to their heart's content and sharing equally. Once they'd satisfied their need for food and drink, each man returned to his own hut to get some rest. But Peleus' son lay moaning loudly on the shore beside the crashing sea with many Myrmidons, in an open spot where waves washed up on shore. When sleep took hold of him and eased his aching heart by sweetly flowing round him, for his splendid limbs were tired out from chasing after Hector by wind-swept Ilion, Then poor Patroclus came to him as a ghost, looking exactly like him in all respects, in stature, handsome eyes, and voice. He stood there above Achilles' head, body covered with the same clothes he used to wear over his skin. The ghost spoke to Achilles, saying, "You're asleep, Achilles. You've forgotten me. While I was alive, you never did neglect me. But now I'm dead. So bury me as quickly as you can. Then I can pass through the gates of Hades. The spirits, ghosts of the dead keep me away. They don't let me join them past the river. So I wander aimlessly round Hades' home by its wide gates. Give me your hand, I beg you, for I'll never come again from Hades once you've given me what's due, my funeral fire. We'll no more sit together making plans, separated from our dear companions. The jaws of dreadful fate are gaping for me, ready to consume me, my destiny from the day that I was born. You too, godlike Achilles, you have your own fate, to die under the walls of wealthy Troy. I'll say one more thing, one last request, if you will listen. Achilles, don't lay your bones apart from mine. Let them remain together just as they were when we grew up in your home, once Menoetius brought me as a youngster into your land from Apoeis, for I'd committed a dreadful murder on that day I slaughtered Amphidamas' son in my foolishness. I didn't mean to. But I was enraged over some game of dice. Horseman Peleus welcomed me into his home, raised me with love, then made me your attendant. So, let the same container hold our bones, that gold two-handled jar your mother gave you." Swift-footed Achilles then said in reply, "Dear friend, why have you come to me here, telling me everything I need to do? I'll carry out all these things for you, attend to your request, but come closer. Let's hold each other one short moment more, enjoying a shared lament together." Saying this, Achilles reached out with his arms, but he grasped nothing. The spirit had departed, going underground like vapor, muttering faintly. Achilles jumped up in amazement, clapped his hands, and then spoke out in sorrow. "How sad! It seems that even in Hades' house some spirit or ghost remains, but our being is not there at all. For this entire night the ghost of poor Patroclus stood beside me, weeping, lamenting, asking me to do things in every detail, amazingly like him." Achilles' words stirred the desire to keep mourning in all of them. When rose-fingered dawn appeared, they were still lamenting by that cheerless corpse. Then mighty Agamemnon sent out men and mules from huts in every quarter to gather wood. The man who supervised was Meriones, brave attendant to kind Idomeneus. They set off, grasping axes to chop wood and well-woven rope. The mules went on ahead. The men kept going up and down the slopes, sometimes tracking sideways, sometimes doubling back, till they reached Ida's foothills with their many springs. At once they started working, cutting high-branched oak trees with their long-edged bronze. Men worked hard, felling each tree with a mighty crash. Achaeans then split the trees into convenient lengths, tied logs behind the mules, whose feet ploughed up the ground as they strained through thick underbrush towards the plain. Woodsmen all carried logs as well, under orders from Meriones, attendant to kind Idomeneus. Men threw these logs down in a line along the shore, where Achilles planned a massive burial mound for Patroclus and himself. When they piled up immense amounts of wood on every side, they sat all together there and waited. Then Achilles quickly told war-loving Myrmidons to dress in bronze, ordering each man to get his horses harnessed in their chariots. They leapt up to get armor on. The warriors and charioteers climbed in their chariots and moved out first. Then came the men on foot in their thousands. In the middle, His companions bore Patroclus, whose corpse they covered with the hair they'd cut from their own heads and thrown onto the body. Godlike Achilles came behind them, cradling Patroclus' head and grieving. For he was sending down to Hades' home a comrade without equal. When they reached the spot Achilles chose for them, they set the body down, then quickly piled up wood as he directed. Then swift-footed Lord Achilles thought of something. Standing some distance from the pyre, he cut a lock of his own fair hair, one he'd grown as a rich offering to the river Spercus. Looking out over the wine-dark sea, he spoke out in passionate distress. "Spercus, my father Peleus promised you that once I came back home to my dear native land, I'd cut my hair for you, then make a holy sacrifice offering 50 uncastrated rams to your waters, where you have your own estate and fragrant altars. That oath was useless. It's what the old man swore, but you failed to bring about what he desired. So now, since I'll not be returning home again, let me give this lock to warrior Patroclus to carry with him." Having said these words, Achilles placed his hair in the hands of his dear comrade, stirring up in each of them desire to lament. Now they would have mourned till sunset, but Achilles soon got up and said to Agamemnon, "Son of Atreus, Achaean troops will listen to your words more than to anyone. Men can grieve too much. So dismiss them from the pyre for now. Tell them to prepare a meal. Those of us with special cause to mourn will take care of this. But let the leaders remain here with us." When Agamemnon, king of men, heard these words, he quickly sent the troops off to their balanced ships. The chief mourners stayed behind. They piled up wood, making a square pyre, each side 100 feet in length. On that pyre's highest point, they laid out the corpse, hearts full of sorrow. Then, in front of the pyre, they flayed and made ready many sturdy sheep and shambling cattle with twisting horns. From all these, great-hearted Achilles took the fat, using it to cover up the corpse from head to foot, piling skinned carcasses around it. Next, he placed on top 2-handled jars of oil and honey, leaning them against the bier. Then, crying with grief, Achilles threw 4 strong-necked horses quickly on the pyre. Patroclus had owned 9 dogs who ate beside his table. Slitting the throats of 2 of them, Achilles tossed them on the pyre. Then, with his bronze, he butchered those 12 noble sons of the courageous Trojans, his feelings grimly set on this atrocity. After that, he lit the fire to work its iron force and burn up everything. With a groan, he called out, addressing his companion, "Rest in peace, Patroclus, though you're in Hades' house, for I'm now completing everything I promised you before. Flames will burn 12 noble sons of great-hearted Trojans, all cremated with you. But as for Hector, Priam's son, I'll not feed him to the fire, but to the dogs." Achilles made this threat, but dogs would not touch Hector, for Aphrodite, Zeus's daughter, kept them away day and night. "I can't sit down. I must return to Achaeana's stream back in the land of Ethiopians, where there's a sacrifice to the immortals. I'd like to be there for that sacred feast. But now Achilles prays that north wind and loud west wind will come. He's promising you splendid offerings to stir the flames so they burn up the pyre where Patroclus lies, whom all Achaea mourns." After saying this, Iris left. The 2 winds rose up. With an astounding roar, driving clouds before them, they quickly stormed across the sea, whipping up waves with their howling breath. They came to fertile Troy, then fell upon that pyre. The fire crackled up into a prodigious blaze. All night long they howled, blowing their shrill blasts together on the flames. And all night long, with a 2-handled cup in hand, swift Achilles kept drawing wine from a golden bowl and pouring it upon the earth, soaking the ground, and calling on the spirit of poor Patroclus. Just as a father mourns his son when he burns his bones, his newly married son whose death brings parents dreadful sorrow, that's how Achilles kept crying then, as he burned his companion's bones, dragging himself around the pyre, lamenting endlessly. But at that hour when the morning star appears, announcing that light is coming to the earth, the star after which Dawn in her yellow robe moves out across the sea, by then the fire was dying. The flames went out. So the winds returned once more, back to their homes, going across the Thracian Sea, where a seething storm roared out. Then Peleus' son, moving away from the smouldering pyre, lay down, exhausted. Sweet sleep slipped quickly round him. But then the troops came up with Agamemnon all together. The noise they made as they marched in woke up Achilles. Sitting bolt upright, he said, "Sons of Atreus, and you other leaders of Achaean forces, you must first douse the smouldering pyre with gleaming wine, everything the powerful flames have touched. Then we'll collect bones from Patroclus, Menoetius' son, separating them with care from all the rest. They're easy to distinguish, for he lay in the centre of the pyre. The others burned some distance from him, on the edges, the humans and the horses. Then let's place his bones inside a golden urn, in a double layer of fat, until the time I myself am hiding there in Hades. I'm asking you to build a burial mound, nothing excessive, what seems appropriate. You Achaeans must build it high and wide, but later, once I'm gone, those who still remain beside our ships with many oars." Once Achilles spoke, they did as the swift-footed son of Peleus wished. First they doused the smoking pyre with gleaming wine, wherever flames had reached or ash was deep. Weeping, they picked the white bones of their comrade out and put them in a double layer of fat inside a golden urn. They placed the urn under soft linen in a hut. Then they traced out the dimensions of a mound, using stones to mark its base around the pyre, and then piled earth on top. When they'd made the mound, they started to return, but Achilles checked them, keeping soldiers there. He asked them to sit down in a wide group. Then he brought prizes from his ship. Cauldrons, tripods, horses, mules, powerful oxen, as well as fine-dressed women and grey iron. First he set out prizes for swift charioteers. For the winner, a woman skilled in fine handicrafts and a tripod with handles holding 20 measures. For second place he led out a mare 6 years old, unbroken and with a mule foal in her womb. For the man who came in third, he set out a cauldron untouched by fire, a fine piece which held 4 measures. For fourth place, he set a prize of 2 gold talents, while the fifth place prize was a 2-handled bowl not yet put on the fire. Then Achilles stood up and spoke directly to the Argives. "Sons of Atreus, you other well-armed Achaean warriors, these prizes lie set out here for a contest among the charioteers. If Achaeans were now hosting these games for someone else, then I myself would surely win first prize and take it to my hut, since, as you know, my horses are far better than the rest, for they're immortal, Poseidon's gift to Peleus, my father, who gave them to me. But I and my sure-footed horses now will stand down, for they've lost their charioteer, a strong, brave man so kind he'd often pour soft oil all through their manes while washing them in clean water. They stand there mourning him, manes trailing on the ground, so they won't race. Their hearts feel too much grief. But you others, get yourselves prepared all through the camp, any Achaean who has faith in his own horses and in his well-made chariot." Once Achilles finished speaking, swift charioteers rushed into action. First to move, well before the rest, was Eumelus, king of men, dear son of Admetus, and excellent with horses. After him came forward mighty Diomedes, son of Tydeus, driving those yoked horses from Tros's herd, which he'd just taken from Aeneas, though Apollo had snatched away their owner. After Diomedes came fair-haired Menelaus, royal son of Atreus, driving a yoked team, 2 fast creatures, his own horse, Podargus, and Agamemnon's mare, Ethe, which Echepolis, Anchises' son, had given to Agamemnon as a gift, so he wouldn't have to go with him to wind-swept Ilion, but could remain at home, enjoying himself, for Zeus had given him great wealth. He lived in spacious Sicyon. This was the mare Menelaus now led up in harness, a racehorse filled with a desire to run. The fourth contestant, Antilochus, got his fair-maned horses ready. He was a noble son of proud King Nestor, son of Neleus. Swift-footed horses bred at Pylos pulled his chariot. His father came up to him to give him practical advice, a wise man speaking to one who could appreciate another's skill. Antilochus, you may still be quite young, but Zeus and Poseidon have been fond of you. They've taught you all sorts of things with horses, so there's no need to issue you instructions. You understand well how to wheel around beside the turning post. But your horses are the slowest in the race, and so I think you've got some problems here to deal with. The others' horses may be faster runners, but the drivers are no better skilled than you. So, dear boy, fix your mind on all that skill, so those prizes don't elude you. You know skill in a woodsman matters more than strength. It's skill that lets a helmsman steer his course, guiding his swift ship straight on wine-dark seas. And it's skill, too, that makes one charioteer go faster than another. Some racing drivers, trusting their chariot and horses, drive them carelessly, moving back and forth, weaving on the course. They don't control their horses. But a cunning man, though he's got worse horses, keeps his eye on that turning point, cutting the pillar close. Such a man also understands how to urge his horses on, right at the start, using his leather reins. But he maintains control. His mind doesn't wander, always watching the man in front. Now, I'll tell you something. There's a marker, so clear you cannot miss it. It's a dry stump of oak or pine standing about 6 feet high. Rain hasn't rotted it. On both sides of that stump, two white stones are firmly fixed against it. At that spot, the race course narrows, but the ground is smooth, so a team can wheel around that stump. It may be a memorial to some man long dead, or perhaps men placed it there to serve as a racing post in earlier times. Swift-footed Lord Achilles has made that stump his turning point. You need to shave that post. Drive in really close as you wheel around your chariot and horses. You should lean out from that well-sprung platform to your horse's left, giving the right-hand horse the lash, calling to him with a shout, while with your hands you let him take the reins. The inside horse must graze the post so the well-built wheel hub seems to scrape the pillar. But be careful. Don't touch the stone, because if you do, you'll hurt the horses and you'll smash the chariot, which will delight the others, but shame you. So, dear boy, take care and pay attention. If you can pass them by as you catch up right by the turning post, then none of them will reach you with a sudden burst of speed, much less overtake you. No, not even if he were driving godlike Arion behind you, that swift horse of Adrestus from heavenly stock, or the very horses of King Laomedon, the finest ones bred here.
Nestor, Neleus' son, spoke and sat down in his place once he'd gone through all the details with his son. Then Meriones, the fifth contestant in the race, harnessed his fine-maned horses, and all the racers climbed in their chariots. They gathered up the lots, which Achilles shook. The first to tumble out was for Antilochus, Nestor's son. Mighty Eumelus was next, then came spearman Menelaus, son of Atreus. After him, Meriones drew his place. Last of all, and by far the best, Tydeus' son drew for his horse's lane. They took their places in a line. Then Achilles showed them the turning point far out on the plain. Beside it, he'd placed an umpire, godlike Phoenix, his father's follower, to observe the racing and report back truthfully. Then all together, they raised their whips above their horses, lashed them with the reins and shouted words of encouragement to urge them forward. The horses raced off quickly, galloping swiftly from the ships. Under their chests, dust came up, hanging there like storm clouds in a whirlwind. In the rushing air, their manes streamed back. The chariots, at one moment, would skim across the nourishing earth, then, in another, would bounce high in the air. Their drivers stood up in the chariots, hearts pounding as they strove for victory. Each man shouted out, calling his horses as they flew along that dusty plain. When the swift horses were starting the last stretch, racing back to the grey sea, their pace grew strained. Then the drivers each revealed his quality. The swift-footed horses of Eumelus raced ahead, followed by Diomedes' team from Tros's breed, not far behind, really close, almost as if they'd charge right up the back of Eumelus' chariot. Their breath felt hot on his broad shoulders and his back, for as they ran ahead they leaned right into him. Now, Tydeus' son would have passed Eumelus, or made the issue doubtful, if Phoebus Apollo, angry at him, hadn't struck the shining whip out of his hand. Then from Diomedes' eyes tears of rage streamed out, once he saw Eumelus' team running even faster than before, while his own were at a disadvantage, running with no whip. But Athene had observed Apollo as he fouled the son of Tydeus. She came running at top speed after that shepherd of his people, then gave back his whip, putting strength into his horses. Then in anger, she went after the son of Admetus. The goddess snapped his chariot yoke. The horses swerved, running all round the course. The shaft dropped down and hit the ground. This threw Eumelus from the chariot beside the wheel. On his elbows, mouth and nose, the skin was badly scraped. Above his eyebrows, his forehead had a bruise, his two eyes filled with tears, his strong voice failed him. Tydeus' son swerved aside, then drove his sure-footed horses far ahead, outdistancing the rest, for Athene had put strength into his team to give Diomedes glory. Behind him came Atreus' son, fair-haired Menelaus. But then Antilochus called to his father's horses, "Get going, you two! Push yourselves! Move up now! As fast as you can go! I'm not asking you to try to beat those horses up ahead, the team of that warlike son of Tydeus, whom Athene has just helped run faster to give their driver glory. But overtake those horses of the son of Atreus. Quick now! Don't let them get too far ahead! You don't want to suffer shame from Ithe, who's just got a mare? Why are you falling back, you strong horses? Let me tell you something, which is sure to happen. If you slack off now and I win an inferior prize, then Nestor, his people's shepherd, will stop feeding you. He'll take out his sharp bronze and kill you both here and now. So keep on after them. Pick up the pace as fast as you can run. My task will be to think of something, devise a way of getting past them there, where the road gets narrow. I won't miss my chance."
Antilochus finished. His horses, frightened by their master's threat, ran faster for a stretch. Suddenly brave Antilochus saw up ahead a place where the road was hollowed out and narrow, with a channel in the ground where winter rains had backed the water up, washing out some of the road and making all the ground subside. Menelaus was coming to this spot, leaving no space at all for a second chariot to move along beside him. But Antilochus guided his sure-footed horses off the track, charging up a little to one side. Atreus' son, alarmed, shouted at Antilochus,
"Antilochus, you're driving like an idiot. Pull your horses back. The road's too narrow. It gets wider soon. You can pass me there. Watch you don't hit me. You'll make us crash."
Menelaus shouted, but Antilochus just kept going, moving even faster and laying on the whip as if he hadn't heard. They raced on like this about as far as a discus flies when thrown with a shoulder swing by a powerful young man, testing his strength. But then the son of Atreus' team slowed down and fell behind, reined in deliberately in case the sure-footed team somehow collided and overturned their well-sprung chariots in the road, leaving their drivers, for all their eagerness to win, sprawling in the dust. Then fair-haired Menelaus, in anger at Antilochus, yelled out,
"Antilochus, you're more reckless than any man alive, damn you! Achaeans were all wrong to think you were a man with some intelligence. But even so, you still may not win the prize without the need to swear you won it fairly."
Menelaus yelled this, then called out to his horses,
"Don't slow down or stand there sad at heart. Their feet and limbs will tire before yours do, for those two horses are no longer young."
Menelaus spoke. Excited by their master's shout, his horses ran on even faster. Meanwhile,
The Argives, sitting all together, kept watching for the horses racing on the dusty plain. The first to spot them was Idomeneus, leader of the Cretans. He sat some distance from the crowd in a higher spot, a fine lookout. The man in front was still far off, but when he called his horses, Idomeneus recognized his voice and could see quite clearly the horse in front. It was all brown, with a mark on his forehead as round and white as a full moon. Idomeneus stood up and called out to the Argives. "My friends, leaders and rulers of Argives, am I the only one to see those horses, or can you glimpse them too? It seems to me that another team is now in front, with another charioteer approaching." "Going out, Eumelus' mares were in the lead, but they must have run into some trouble out there, somewhere on the plain. I saw them wheeling round the turning post in front. Now I can't see them anywhere, though my eyes keep searching the entire Trojan plain. Perhaps the charioteer let go the reins and couldn't guide his chariot round the post and failed to make the turn. I think he fell out there somewhere and smashed his chariot. His horses must have panicked in their hearts and run away. But stand up, look for yourselves. I can't see all that clearly, but the man seems to be of Aetolian descent, an Argive king, mighty Diomedes, son of horse-taming Tydeus." At that point, swift Ajax, son of Oileus, mocked Idomeneus with these insulting words. "Idomeneus, why are you always nattering? Those prancing mares are still far distant, with a lot more ground to race across. And of all the Argives here, you're not the youngest. Those eyes in your head don't have the keenest vision. But for all that, you still chatter on. You don't need to babble when there are better men than you around. Those same mares are out in front, as before. Eumelus' team, and he's standing there as well, holding the reins." The leader of the Cretans, furious with Ajax, then replied, "You're great at insults, Ajax, but really stupid. In everything, you are the most useless Argive of them all, because your mind is dull. Come on, then. Let's bet a tripod or a cauldron on it. Which horses are in front, so you'll learn by having to pay up. As our umpire, let's have Agamemnon, son of Atreus." At Idomeneus's words, swift Ajax, son of Oileus, jumped up at once in a rage, ready to answer with more angry words. At that point, their quarrel might have got much worse, but Achilles himself stood up and said, "No more of this. Idomeneus and Ajax, no more angry words, no more insults. That's not appropriate. You'd both feel indignation if another man behaved this way. So sit down with the group and watch for horses. It won't be long before their eagerness to win brings them here. Then you can both see the Argive horses, who's in the lead and who's behind." As Achilles spoke, Tydeus' son came charging in really close to them. He kept swinging his whip down from the shoulder, so his horses raced ahead, raising their hooves up high as they ran the course. Clouds of dust kept falling on the charioteer, as his chariot made of gold and tin raced on, drawn by swift-running horses, who left behind only a slight trace of wheel rims in the dust as the team flew speeding by. Diomedes pulled up right in the middle of the crowd. Streams of sweat dripped from the horses' necks and chests onto the ground. He jumped down from his gleaming chariot, leaning the whip against the yoke. Strong Sthenelus didn't wait for long to get the prizes. He retrieved them right away, giving the woman to his proud comrades to lead off and the two-handled tripod to carry with them. Then he untied the horses from their harnesses. Next in came the horses driven by Antilochus, grandson of Neleus, who just beat Menelaus. He won by cunning, not by his horse's speed. But Menelaus was bringing his swift horses in very close behind. The space between the two was as far as a horse is from the chariot wheel, when it strains to pull its master fast across the plain. Its tail ends touch the spinning wheels behind it. There's not much space between them as they move at top speed on the plain. That's about how far Menelaus lagged behind noble Antilochus. At first, he'd been about a discus throw behind, but he was quickly catching up, for the spirit in Agamemnon's mare, the fair-maned Ethe, kept getting stronger. Had the course been longer for both contestants, he'd have surely passed him without leaving the result in doubt. The next one in was Meriones, Idomeneus' brave attendant, a spear-throw length behind splendid Menelaus. His horses were the slowest, and he himself had the least skill at driving in a chariot race. Last one in was Admetus' son, well behind the rest, driving his horses in front of him and pulling his chariot behind. Seeing Eumelus coming in, swift-footed Lord Achilles felt sorry for him. Standing among Argives, he spoke these winged words. "The best man brings up his sure-footed horses in last place. Come, let's give him a prize, as seems fitting, the award for second place. Let Diomedes take the first place prize." Achilles spoke. They all agreed with his suggestion. So now he would have given Eumelus the mare, as Achaeans had agreed. But Antilochus, great-hearted Nestor's son, stood up to claim his right. Addressing Achilles, son of Peleus, he said, "Achilles, I'll be angry with you if you carry out what you've proposed, for you want to rob me of my prize, claiming that his chariot and swift horses run into trouble, as he did himself, though he's an excellent charioteer. But he should have prayed to the immortals, then in the race he would not have finished last. If you're feeling sorry for Eumelus, if he's someone your heart is fond of, in your hut there's lots of gold. You've got bronze, sheep, women slaves, and sure-footed horses. Why not take some of that, and then give him an even greater prize sometime later on? Or do it now. Achaeans will applaud you, but I won't give up the mare. If someone wants her, let him try doing battle with me, hand to hand." Antilochus finished speaking. Swift-footed, godlike Achilles smiled, delighted with Antilochus, who was a close companion. In reply, he spoke these winged words. "Antilochus, if you're telling me to give Eumelus some other prize inside my huts, I'll do it. I'll give him the breastplate I took away from Asteropaeus. It's made of bronze with a casting of bright tin around it. For Eumelus, it will have great value." After saying this, Achilles ordered Automedon, his close companion, to fetch the breastplate from the hut. He went and brought it back and gave it to Eumelus, who was delighted to receive the armor. But then Menelaus stood up before them all. His heart was bitter with unremitting anger against Antilochus. A herald put the scepter in Menelaus' hand, then shouted out for silence among the Argives. Godlike Menelaus spoke. "Antilochus, you used to have good sense before all this. But now look at what you've done. You've brought my skills here into disrepute, fouling my horses when you hurled your team in front of me out there, that team of yours which is far inferior to mine. Come now, you leaders and rulers of the Argives, judge between the two of us, and fairly, so Achaeans armed in bronze will never say Menelaus beat Antilochus with lies when he received that mare. Though his own horses were much slower, he used his influence, his rank and power. In fact, I myself will judge the case, and no Danaan, I claim, will find fault with me in any way, for justice will be done. Antilochus, come here, my lord, and as our customs state, stand there before your chariot and horses, holding that thin whip you used before. With your hand on your horses, swear an oath by the god who surrounds and shakes the earth that you didn't mean to block my chariot with some trick." Antilochus, a prudent man, replied, "Don't let me offend you, King Menelaus. I'm a younger man than you. You're my senior and my better. You know how a young man can do foolish things. His mind works quickly, but his judgment's suspect. So be patient in your heart. That mare I was awarded, I freely give you. And if you requested something greater from my own possessions, I'd want to give it to you right away, rather than lose your goodwill, my lord, forever, and offend against the gods." The son of great-hearted Nestor finished speaking. He led out the horse, then placed it in the hands of Menelaus, whose heart melted like the dew on ripening ears of corn when fields are bristling with a crop. That's how, Menelaus, your heart softened in your chest. He spoke to Antilochus. His words had wings. "Now indeed, Antilochus, I'll give up my anger with you. Before now, you haven't been too reckless or a fool. This time your youth overcame your reason. In future, you shouldn't try to do such tricks against your betters. Another Achaean would not have won me over quite so fast, but you've worked very hard, endured a lot. You, your noble father, and your brother, in my cause, so I'll agree to your request. What's more, although she's mine, I'll give you the mare, so all these people here will recognize. My heart's not arrogant or unyielding. Saying this, Menelaus gave the mare to Noaemon, a comrade of Antilochus, to lead away. Menelaus carried off the shining cauldron. Meriones then collected the 2 talents for his 4th-place finish, but the prize for 5th-place, the 2-handled jar, went unclaimed. So Achilles awarded it to Nestor. Carrying the prize into the crowd of Argives, he stood beside him. Then Achilles said, "Take this now, old man. Let it be your treasure in memory of Patroclus' burial, for you'll see him no more among the Argives. This prize I'm giving you without a contest, for you won't be competing as a boxer, or in wrestling, or the spear throw. Nor will you be running in the foot race, for old age now has you in its cruel grip." With these words, Achilles placed the jar in Nestor's hands. He was happy to accept it. Then Nestor spoke, saying these winged words to Achilles.
"Indeed, my son, you've made a valid point, for my limbs and feet are no longer firm, my friend, nor do I find it as easy to extend my arms out from my shoulders as I did before. Would that I were young, my strength as firm as it was that day, Epeion's buried lord Amarynceus at Buprasium, his sons awarded prizes in honour of their king. No man could match me, none of the Epeians, my own Pylians, nor any of the brave Aetolians. In boxing I defeated Clitomedes, Enops's son, in wrestling Anchaos from Pleuron, who fought against me. In the foot race I outran Iphicles, who was outstanding, and in the spear throw I beat Phyleus and Polydorus. I was beaten only in the chariot race by the 2 sons of Actor. They pushed ahead, for there were 2 of them, both really keen to win, because they'd set the greatest prize for that particular race. They were 2 twins. One always held the reins, he was the driver. The other used the whip. That's the man I was back then. But now let younger men compete in events like these, for I must follow the dictates of a cruel old age these days, though as a warrior I once excelled. But come, you must continue with these games to honour your companion. As for this gift, I accept it gladly. It delights my heart that you think of me always as your friend. You don't forget the honours due to me among Achaeans. May the gods grant you, as a reward for that, your heart's desires."
Nestor finished. Once he'd heard all of Nestor's story, Peleus' son moved through the large Achaean crowd. Then he set out prizes for the painful contest, the boxing. To the group he led out a sturdy mule, an unbroken female 6 years old, the hardest to break in. For the loser he put out a cup, one with 2 handles. Then Achilles, standing up, addressed the Argives. "Son of Atreus, all you other well-armed Achaeans, for these prizes here, we need 2 good men, the best there are, to put up their fists and box. The one to whom Apollo gives endurance and Achaeans all acknowledge winner, let him then take this mule back to his hut. The beaten man gets this 2-handled cup. Achilles' words at once stirred into action a strong, brave man, well skilled in boxing, Epeius, son of Panopeus. Putting his hand on the mule, Epeius said, "Let whoever's going to get the 2-handled cup step forward, for I say this. No Achaean will beat me with his fists and take this mule. I claim I'm the winner. I may not be the best in battle, so what? A man can't be well skilled in everything. But I'll say this, and what I say will happen. I'll break apart the skin and crush the bones of the man who fights me. Those close to him had better stay here in a single group to help him off, once my fists have thrashed him." Epeius' words reduced them all to silence. The only one to stand up to oppose him was godlike Euryalus, son of Mecistius, son of Talaeus. He'd once come to Thebes for the funeral games of fallen Oedipus. There he'd triumphed against all the sons of Cadmus. Famous spearman Diomedes helped him prepare, encouraging Euryalus with his words. He really wanted him to win the contest. First he set the loincloth on him, then gave him leather thongs, fine cut hide from a farmyard ox. When the two men had laced up their hands, they strode into the middle of the group. Raising their arms, their powerful fists, they went at each other. Their hands exchanged some heavy punches, landing with painful crunches on their jaws. From their limbs, sweat ran down everywhere. Then Euryalus fainted, but godlike Epeius moved and punched his cheekbone. Euryalus could not keep his feet for long. His splendid limbs collapsed there on the spot. As a fish jumps through the rippling surface water in a forceful north wind breeze near a weed-filled shore before a black wave hides it, that's how Euryalus jerked up as he was hit. But great-hearted Epeius grabbed him and set him on his feet. Around him his close comrades gathered. They led him through the crowd, spitting gobs of blood, dragging his feet behind him with his head down on one side. They took him off, set him down with them, still semi-conscious, then went themselves to collect the two-handled cup. For the Danaans, Peleus' son then set out a display of prizes for the third contest, the hard-fought wrestling match. The winning prize was a huge tripod to place above a fire, whose value among themselves Achaeans set at 12 oxen. Into the middle of the crowd he then brought out the loser's prize, a woman skilled in every kind of work, worth 4 oxen. Standing up among the Argives, Achilles said, "Step up now, the two who'll try this contest." At these words, great Telamonian Ajax got up, as did Odysseus, the crafty master of deceit. They strapped on their belts and strode out to the crowd, then with their powerful hands gripped each other's elbows, locked together like rafters on some lofty house, fitted by skilled craftsmen to keep out blasts of wind. Their backs cracked as their strong hands applied the pressure. Streams of sweat poured down, and red blood welts appeared across their ribs and shoulders as both contestants kept up their struggle to prevail and get the prize, that well-made tripod. But it was impossible for Odysseus to trip up Ajax or throw him down, or for Ajax to do the same thing to Odysseus, for Odysseus' strength prevented him from that. But when well-armed Achaeans started to get bored, great Telamonian Ajax said to Odysseus, "Divinely born son of Laertes, resourceful Odysseus, try lifting me, or I'll try lifting you, and we'll let Zeus decide the outcome." Saying this, Ajax tried a lift. But Odysseus did not forget his various tricks. He kicked Ajax behind the knee, taking out his leg. Ajax toppled backward, with Odysseus falling on his chest. The spectators got excited then. Next, resilient, godlike Odysseus tried a lift. He managed to move Ajax off the ground a bit, but couldn't lift him. Then Ajax hooked him with his leg around the knee, so the two men fell close together on the ground, covered both in dust. Now they would have jumped up to wrestle a third fall, but Achilles himself came up and held them back. "You two need not continue wrestling. Don't let the pain exhaust you, for both of you are winners. You must take equal prizes. Once you leave, other Achaeans can compete." Hearing these words, both men agreed. The two of them cleaned their bodies of the dust and put on tunics. After that, Peleus' son quickly set out other prizes for the foot race, a finely crafted silver mixing bowl holding 6 measures. It was very beautiful, the loveliest object in the world by far. Sidonian experts in skilled handicrafts who made it had shaped it well. Then Phoenician men had brought it over the dark sea, unpacked it in the harbour, and given it as a gift to Thoas, a ransom for Lycaon, Priam's son, paid by Euneus, son of Jason, to warrior Patroclus. This bowl Achilles set out as a prize to honour his companion, a trophy for the man who in the foot race proved he was the fastest. As prize for second place, he led out a huge ox, rich in fat. For third place, he offered 1/2 a talent. Then Achilles stood up and announced to the Achaeans, "Up, all those of you who want to make the effort for this prize." At that, swift Oilean Ajax jumped up at once. Next came resourceful Odysseus and Nestor's son Antilochus, who, of all the young men there, could run the fastest. These men stood in line as Achilles pointed out the turning post. The race course was the distance there and back. The son of Oileus quickly raced in front with godlike Odysseus really close behind, as close as the weaving bar comes to the breast of a well-dressed woman when she deftly pulls it in her hands to pass the weaving spool through thread, keeping the rod against her chest. That's how close Odysseus ran behind, his feet hitting Ajax's footprints before the dust could settle there. Godlike Odysseus ran so close, his breath touched the back of Ajax's head. All the Achaeans were cheering on Odysseus as he strove to win the race, yelling at him to push his energy right to the limit. While they were running the last section of the course, Odysseus in his heart prayed to Athene, goddess with the glittering eyes. "Hear me, goddess, be good to me, help me, speed up my feet." Odysseus prayed, and Pallas Athene heard him. She made his legs, feet, and upper arms feel lighter. Then, as they were about to sprint in for the prize, Ajax slipped in mid-stride, for Athene fouled him, right where the bellowing cattle had dropped their dung as they were slaughtered, the ones which swift Achilles had killed in honour of Patroclus. So Ajax finished with his mouth and nostrils full of dung, as resilient Odysseus raced ahead, came in first, and won the prize. Ajax got the ox. He stood there, hands on the horn of that farmyard beast, spitting out cow dung, and then said to the Argives, "So the goddess played tricks with my feet, the one that always helps Odysseus out, taking care of him, just like a mother." Ajax spoke. They all had a good laugh at him. Antilochus took the prize for coming last. He smiled, then said, as he spoke to the Argives, "Friends, I'll tell you this, something you already know. Immortal gods still honour older men even today, for Ajax is only a little older than myself. But Odysseus comes from another time, an older generation. But his greater age, so people say, is green. So it's difficult for Achaeans to beat him in a race, all except Achilles." Antilochus finished speaking. He'd acknowledged the swift-footed son of Peleus. So Achilles answered him and said, "Antilochus, you've not paid that tribute here for nothing. I'll add a gold half-talent to your prize." With these words, Achilles handed him the gold. Antilochus was very pleased to get it. Next, the son of Peleus brought to the gathering a long-shadowed spear. He set it down and with it a shield and helmet. It was Sarpedon's armour, which Patroclus had taken from him. Standing there, Achilles then said to the Argives, "We're calling for two men, two of the best, to battle for these prizes, clothed in armour, wielding their sharp bronze, testing each other here before this crowd. Whichever man hits the other's fair skin first, under the armour, drawing his dark blood, will get from me this silver-studded sword, a lovely one from Thrace which I seized from Asteropaeus. Both men will take this armour here, sharing it in common, and in my hut we'll get a banquet ready for both of them." Achilles finished. Then great Telamonian Ajax moved out front, and strong Diomedes, son of Tydeus, got up. On each side of the crowd they armed themselves. Then both strode to the middle, prepared to fight, both glaring fearfully. All Achaeans were then gripped with anxious expectation. Once the two men approached each other at close quarters, they attacked, charging three times going at it hand to hand. Ajax struck through the even circle of the shield of his opponent, but did not touch his flesh. The breastplate kept his body guarded from the spear. Tydeus's son was trying to aim his gleaming spear point over the huge shield to get Ajax in the neck. But then Achaeans in their fear for Ajax called for a halt and an award of equal prizes. So Achilles gave the great sword to Diomedes, the scabbard and the well-cut strap as well. Then Peleus' son put out a lump of rough-cast iron, which in earlier days Eetion had used for throwing. Godlike, swift-footed Achilles had slaughtered him, then taken his iron and all his other goods away in his swift ship. Achilles then stood up and addressed the Argives. "Step up, all those who want to try this competition. Whoever wins this iron can use it to serve his needs for 5 successive years, even though his rich fields are far away. His herders and his ploughmen will not need to travel to the town through lack of iron. This will give them all that they require." Achilles spoke. Then up came Polypoetes, a strong fighter and godlike Cleontius, a powerful man, then Telamonian Ajax, and godlike Epeus. They stood there in a line. Godlike Epeus gripped the weight, swung it round, then threw. The Achaeans all laughed at the result. The second one to throw was Leontius, offshoot of Ares. Great Ajax, son of Telamon, was third to throw. His strong hand tossed the weight, hurling it beyond the marks of all the others. But then that strong warrior Polypoetes picked up the weight and threw it even further than all those in the contest, by the same distance a herdsman throws his staff, so it flies spinning in among his cattle herd. The crowd all shouted. Then the comrades of strong Polypoetes stood up and carried off their king's prize to the hollow ships. Next, Achilles set out the prizes for the archers, things made of blackened iron, 10 double axes and 10 with single blades. Then he set up, far off in the sands, the mast of a dark-prowed ship. Attached to it with a slender cord, he placed a quivering dove with the cord tied to its foot. He then told competitors to shoot the dove. "The man who hits it, the quivering dove, can carry off all these double axes. He can take them home. If he misses the bird and hits the cord, he'll be less successful, but he'll take as prize these single-bladed axes." Achilles finished speaking. Powerful Lord Teucer then got up, and Meriones, courageous attendant to Lord Idomeneus. They took lots and shook them in a helmet made of bronze. Teucer's lot gave him first attempt. He fired an arrow, a powerful shot, but he'd made no promise to Apollo that he'd give a splendid offering of newborn lambs, so he failed to hit the bird. Apollo wouldn't give him that. But he hit the cord, tethering the bird near its foot, and cut it. The keen arrow sliced right through. The dove escaped, flying up into the sky, cord dangling down towards the ground. Achaeans then all cheered the shot, but Meriones quickly snatched the bow from Teucer. He'd been holding an arrow ready for some time as Teucer aimed. He offered up a rapid prayer to Apollo, the far shooter, promising he'd make a splendid sacrifice of newborn lambs. He saw the trembling dove high up under the clouds. As she circled there, he shot her through the middle, under the wing. The arrow passed straight through, falling back to earth again. It struck by Meriones' foot. The dove fluttered to the mast of the dark-prowed ship, her head hung down, her wings drooped as life fled quickly from her limbs. She fell from the mast a long way to the ground. The crowd looked on amazed, so Meriones carried off 10 double axes, while Teucer took back to his hollow ships the single-bladed ones. Then Peleus' son brought out a long-shadowed spear and set it down before the gathering, and a brand-new cauldron, not yet touched by fire, with a floral pattern on it. Its value was 1 ox. Then warriors got up for the spear-throw competition. The son of Atreus, wide-ruling Agamemnon, and Meriones, courageous attendant to Lord Idomeneus. But then swift-footed, godlike Achilles spoke. "Son of Atreus, we know how you surpass all others, how in the spear-throw you're much stronger, better than anyone. So take this prize as you go to your hollow ships. Let's give the spear to warrior Meriones if your heart is pleased with that. It's what I'd like to do." Achilles spoke. Agamemnon, king of men, agreed. The warrior king gave the spear to Meriones, then handed his own prize, the lovely cauldron, over to Talthybius, his herald.
That's the end of today's audiobook break. You've been listening to Homer's The Iliad, read by Anton Lesser and published by Naxos Audiobooks. It's one of a remarkable series of classic books published by Naxos. For a full list, go to naxosaudiobooks.com. And check out audiophilemagazine.com for reviews of hundreds of audiobooks so you can make the right listening choice. This has been Audiobook Break with Audiophile Magazine. I'm Joe Reed. Good listening.